their tastiness. The women told which villages they came from and the names they would go by. My mother did not let it be known that she had already had two children, and that some of these girls were young enough to be her daughters. Then everyone went to the auditorium for 2 hours of speeches by the faculty. They told the students that they would begin with a text as old as the Han Empire, when the prescription for immortality had not yet been lost. Chang Chengqing, father of medicine, had told how the two great winds, Yang and Yin, blew through the human body. The diligent students would do well to begin tonight memorizing his book on colds and fevers. After they had mastered the ancient cures that worked, they would be taught the most up-to-date Western discoveries. By the time the students graduated, those of them who persevered, their range of knowledge would be wider than that of any other doctor in history. "Women have now been practicing medicine for about 50 years," said one of the teachers, a woman, who complimented them for adding to their growing number and also for coming to a school that taught modern medicine. "You will bring science to the villages." At the end of the program, the faculty turned their backs to the students, and everyone bowed the three bows toward the picture of Dr. Sun Yat-sen, who was a Western surgeon before he became a revolutionary. Then they went to the dining hall to eat. My mother began memorizing her books immediately after supper. There were two places where a student could study: the dining hall with its tables cleared for work, everyone chanting during the common memorization sessions, or the table in her own room. Most students went to the dining hall for the company there. My mother usually stayed in her room, or when a roommate wanted the privacy of it also, went to a secret hiding place she had hunted out during the first week of school. Once in a while, she dropped by the dining hall, chanted for a short while with the most advanced group, not missing a syllable, yawned early, and said goodnight. She quickly built a reputation for being brilliant, a natural scholar who could glance at a book and know it. "The other students fought over who would sit next to me at exams," says my mother. "One glimpse at my paper when they got stuck, and they could keep going." "Did you ever try to stop them from copying your paper?" "Of course not. They only needed to pick up a word or two, and they could remember the rest. That's not copying. You get a lot more clues in actual diagnosis. Patients talk endlessly about their ailments. I'd feel their pulses knocking away under my very fingertips, so much clearer than the paper dolls in the textbooks. I'd chant the symptoms, and those few words would start a whole chapter of cures tumbling out. Most people don't have the kind of brains that can do that." She pointed at the photograph of the 37 graduates. 112 students began the course at the same time I did. She suspected she did not have the right kind of brains either. My father, the one who can recite whole poems. To make up the lack, she did secret studying. She also gave herself 20 years head start over the young girls, although she admitted to only 10, which already forced her to push. Older people were expected to be smarter. They are closer to the gods. She did not want to overhear students or teachers say, "She must be exceedingly stupid, doing no better than anyone else when she is a generation older. She's so dumb, she has to study day and night." "I studied far in advance," says my mother. "I studied when the breathing coming from the beds and coming through the wood walls were deep and even. The night before exams, when the other students stayed up, I went to bed early. They would say, 'Aren't you going to study?' And I'd say, 'No, I'm going to do some mending,' or 'I want to write letters tonight.' I let them take turns sitting next to me at the tests." The sweat of hard work is not to be displayed. It is much more graceful to appear favored by the gods. Maybe my mother's secret place was the room in the dormitory, which was haunted. Even though they had to crowd the other rooms, none of the young women would sleep in it. Accustomed to nestling with a bed full of siblings and grannies, they fitted their privacy tighter rather than claim the haunted room as human territory. No one had lived in it for at least 5 years, not since a series of hauntings had made its inhabitants come down with ghost fear that shattered their brains for studying. The haunted ones would give high, startled cries, pointing at the air, which sure enough was becoming hazy. They would suddenly turn and go back the way they had come. When they rounded a corner, they flattened themselves fast against a building to catch what followed unawares, moving steadily forward. One girl tore up the photograph she had taken of friends in that room. The stranger with arms hanging at its sides who stood beside the wall in the background of the photograph was a ghost. The girl would insist there had been nobody there when she took the picture. "That was a photo ghost," said my mother when the students talked a story. She needn't have been afraid. Most ghosts are only nightmares. Somebody should have held her and wiggled her ears to wake her up. My mother relished these scare orgies. She was good at naming. Wall ghost, frog spirit, frogs are heavenly chickens. Eating partner. She would find descriptions of phenomena in ancient writings, the Green Phoenix stories, the seven strange tales of the golden bottle, what Confucius did not talk about. She could validate ghost sightings. "But ghosts can't be just nightmares," a storyteller protested. "They come right out into the room. Once, our whole family saw wine cups spinning and incense sticks waving through the air. We got the magic monk to watch all night. He also saw the incense tips tracing orange figures in the dark. Ideographs, he said. He followed the glow patterns with his ink brush on red paper, and there it was, a message from our great-grandfather. We needed to put bigger helpings and a Ford in front of his plaque, and when we did, the haunting stopped immediately. I like to think the ancestors are busier than that, my mother said, or more at rest. Yes, they're probably more at rest. Perhaps it was an animal spirit that was bothering your house, and your grandfather had something to do with chasing it off. After what she thought was a suitably tactful pause, she said, "How do we know that ghosts are the continuance of dead people? Couldn't ghosts be an entirely different species of creature? Perhaps human beings just die, and that's the end. I don't think I'd mind that too much. Which would you rather be, a ghost who is constantly wanting to be fed, or nothing?" If the other storytellers had been reassuring one another with science, then my mother would have flown stories as factual as bats into the listening night. A practical woman, she would not invent stories and told only true ones. But tonight the younger women were huddling together under the quilts, the ghost room with its door open steps away. "Did you hear that?" someone would whisper. And sure enough, whenever their voices stilled simultaneously, a thump or a creak would unmistakably sound somewhere inside the building. The girls would jump closer together, giggling. "That was the wind," my mother would say. "That was somebody who fell asleep reading in bed. She dropped her book. She neither jumped nor giggled." "If you're so sure," said an impertinent girl, perhaps the one with the disdainful chin, "why don't you go out there and take a look?" "Of course," said my mother. "I was just thinking about doing that." And she took a lamp and left her friends, impressed, in a dimmer room. She advanced steadily, waking the angular shadows up and down the corridor. She walked to both ends of the hallway, then explored another wing for good measure. At the ghost room, door open like a mouth. She stopped, and stepping inside, swung light into its corners. She saw cloth bags in knobby mounds. They looked like gnomes, but were not gnomes. Suitcases and boxes threw shadow stairs up the walls and across the floor. Nothing unusual loomed at her or scurried away. No temperature change, no smell. She turned her back on the room and slowly walked through one more wing. She did not want to get back too soon. Her friends, although one owes nothing to friends, must be satisfied that she searched thoroughly. After a sufficiently brave time, she returned to the storytellers. "I saw nothing," she said. "There's nothing to be afraid of in the whole dormitory, including the ghost room. I checked there, too. I went inside just now." "The haunting begins at midnight," said the girl with the adamantine chin. "It's not quite 11. My mother may have been afraid, but she would be a dragoness. My totem, your totem. She would make herself not weak. During danger, she fanned out her dragon claws and riffled her red sequined scales and unfolded her coiling green stripes. Danger was a good time for showing off. Like the dragons living in Temple Eves, my mother looked down on plain people who were lonely and afraid. "I'm so sleepy," my mother said. "I don't want to wait up until midnight. I'll go sleep in the ghost room. Then if anything happens, I won't miss it. I hope I'll be able to recognize the ghost when I see it. Sometimes ghosts put on such mundane disguises. They aren't particularly interesting." "Aya, aya," the storytellers exclaimed. My mother laughed with satisfaction at their cries. "I'll call out if something bad happens to me," she said. "If you come running altogether, you will probably be able to scare any ghost away." Some of them promised to come. Some offered their talismans. A branch from a peach tree, a Christian cross, a red paper with good words written on it. But my mother refused them all. "If I take charms, then the ghost will hide from me. I won't learn what kind of ghost it is, or whether or not a ghost lives in there at all. I'll only bring a knife to defend myself and a novel in case I get bored and can't sleep. You keep the charms. Should I call for help, bring them with you." She went to her own room and got weapon and book, though not a novel, but a textbook. Two of her roommates walked her to the ghost room. "Aren't you afraid?" they asked. "What is there to be afraid of?" she asked. "What could a ghost do to me?" But my mother did pause at the door. "Listen," she said. "If I am very afraid when you find me, don't forget to tweak my ears. Call my name and tell me how to get home." She told them her personal name. She walked directly to the back of the room where the boxes formed a window seat. She sat with the lamp beside her and stared at her yellow and black reflection in the night glass. "I am very pretty," she thought. She cupped her hands to the window to see out. A thin moon pricked through the clouds and the long grass waved. "That is the same moon that they see in the New Society Village," she thought. "The same stars." "That is the same moon that they see in China. The same stars, though shifted a little." When she set the lamp next to the bed, the room seemed darker, the uncurtained window letting in the bare night. She wrapped herself well in her quilt, which her mother had made before dying young. In the middle of one border, my grandmother had sewn a tiny satin triangle, a red heart to protect my mother at the neck, as if she were her baby yet. My mother read aloud. Perhaps the others could hear how calmly. The ghost might hear her, too. She did not know whether her voice would evoke it or disperse it. Soon the ideographs lifted their feet, stretched out their wings, and flew like black birds. The dots were their eyes. Her own eyes drooped. She closed a book and turned off the lamp. A new darkness pulled away the room, inked out flesh and outlined bones. My mother was wide awake again. She became sharply herself, bone, wire, antenna. But she was not afraid. She had been pared down like this before, when she had traveled up the mountains into rare snow, alone in white, not unlike being alone in black. She had also sailed a boat safely between land and land. She did not know whether she had fallen asleep or not when she heard a rushing coming out from under the bed. Cringes of fear seized her souls as something alive, rumbling, climbed the foot of the bed. It rolled over her and landed bodily on her chest. There it sat. It breathed airlessly, pressing her, sapping her. "Oh no, a sitting ghost," she thought. She pushed against the creature to lever herself out from underneath it, but it absorbed this energy and got heavier. Her fingers and palms became damp, shrinking at the ghost's thick, short hair like an animal's coat, which slides against warm solidity as human flesh slides against muscles and bones. She grabbed clutches of fur and pulled. She pinched the skin the hair grew out of and gouged into it with her fingernails. She forced her hands to hunt out eyes, furtive somewhere in the hair, but could not find any. She lifted her head to bite but fell back exhausted. The mass thickened. She could see the knife, which was catching the moonlight near the lamp. Her arm had become an immensity, though, too burdensome to lift. If she could only move it to the edge of the bed, perhaps it would fall off and reach the knife. As if feeding on her very thoughts, the ghost spread itself over her arm. A high ringing sound somewhere had grown loud enough so that she heard it, and she understood that it had started humming at the edge of her brain before the ghost appeared. She breathed shallowly, panting as in childbirth, and could not shout out. The room sang, its air electric with the ringing. Surely someone would hear and come help. Earlier in the night, on the other side of the ringing, she could hear women's voices talking. But soon their conversations had ceased. The school slept. She could feel that the souls had gone traveling. There was a lightness not in the dormitory during the day. Without looking at the babies on her back or in their cribs, she had always been able to tell, after the rocking and singing and bedtime stories and keeping still not to startle them, the moment when they fell asleep. A tensing goes out of their bodies, out of the house. Beyond the horror in the ghost room, she felt this release throughout the dormitory. No one would come to see how she was doing. "You will not win, Boulder," she spoke to the ghost. "You do not belong here, and I will see to it that you leave. When morning comes, only one of us will control this room, ghost, and that will be me. I will be marching its length and width. I will be dancing, not sliding and creeping like you. I will go right out that door, but I'll come back. Do you know what gift I will bring you? I'll get fire, ghost. You made a mistake haunting a medical school. We have cabinets full of alcohol, laboratories full. We have a communal kitchen with human-sized jars of oil and cooking fat. Enough to burn for a month without our skipping a single fried meal. I will pour alcohol into my wash bucket and I'll set fire to it. Ghost, I will burn you out. I will swing the bucket across the ceiling. Then from the kitchen, my friends will come with the lard. When we fire it, the smoke will fill every crack and corner. Where will you hide, ghost? I will make this room so clean no ghost will ever visit here again. I do not give in, she said. There is no pain you can inflict that I cannot endure. You're wrong if you think I'm afraid of you. You're no mystery to me. I've heard of you sitting ghosts before. Yes, people have lived to tell about you. You kill babies, you cowards. You have no power over a strong woman. You are no more dangerous than a nesting cat. My dog sits on my feet more heavily than you can. You think this is suffering? I could make my ears ring louder by taking aspirin. Are these all the tricks you have, ghost, sitting and ringing? That is nothing. A broom ghost can do better. You cannot even assume an interesting shape. Merely a boulder, a hairy butt boulder. You must not be a ghost at all. Of course, there are no such things as ghosts. Let me instruct you, boulder. When Yen, the teacher, was grading the provincial exams one year, a thing with hair as ugly as yours plopped itself on his desk. That one had glaring eyes, though, so it wasn't blind and stupid like you. Yen picked up his ferrule and hit it like a student. He chased it around the room. It wasn't lame and lazy. And it vanished. Later Yen taught us. After life, the rational soul ascends the dragon. The sentient soul descends the dragon. So in the world there can be no ghosts. This thing must have been a fox spirit. That must be just what you are, a fox spirit. You are so hairy you must be a fox that doesn't even know how to transform itself. You're not clever for a fox spirit, I must say. No tricks, no blood. Where are your hanged man's rotting noose and icy breath? No throwing shoes into the rafters? No metamorphosis into a beautiful sad lady? No disguises in my dead relative's shapes? No drowned woman with seaweed hair? No riddles or penalty games? You are a puny little boulder indeed. Yes, when I get my oil, I will fry you for breakfast. She then ignored the ghost on her chest and chanted her lessons for the next day's classes. The moon moved from one window to the other, and as dawn came, the thing scurried off, climbing quickly down the foot of the bed. She fell asleep until time for school. She had said she was going to sleep in that room, and so she did. She awoke when the students came tumbling into the room. "What happened?" they asked, getting under the quilt to keep warm. "Did anything happen?" "Take my earlobes, please," said my mother, "and pull them back and forth. In case I lost any of myself, I want you to call me back." I was afraid, and fear may have driven me out of my body and mind. Then I will tell you the story. Two friends clasped her hands, while a third held her head and took each earlobe between thumb and forefinger, wiggling them and chanting, come home, brave orchid, who has fought the ghosts and won. Return to To Kwan School, Kwantung City, Kwantung Province. Your classmates are here waiting for you, scholarly, brave orchid. Come home, come home. Come back and help us with our lessons. School is starting soon. Come for breakfast. Return, daughter of New Society Village, Kwantung Province. Your brother and sisters call you. Your friends call you. We need you. Return to us. Return to us at the To Kwan School. There's work to do. Come back, Dr. Brave Orchid. Be unafraid. Be unafraid. You are safe now in the To Kwan School. All is safe. Return. Abundant comfort in long, restoring waves warmed my mother. Her soul returned fully to her and nestled happily inside her skin. For this moment, not traveling in the past where her children were, nor to America to be with my father. She was back among many people. She rested after battle. She let friends watch out for her. "There," said the roommate, giving her ear a last hearty tug. "You're cured. Now tell us what happened." "I had finished reading my novel," said my mother, "and still nothing happened. I was listening to the dogs bark far away. Suddenly, a full-grown sitting ghost loomed up to the ceiling and pounced on top of me. Mounds of hair hid its claws and teeth. No true head, no eyes, no face. So low in its level of incarnation, it did not have the shape of a recognizable animal. It knocked me down and began to strangle me. It was bigger than a wolf, bigger than an ape, and growing. I would have stabbed it. I would have cut it up, and we would be mopping blood this morning, but a sitting ghost mutation. It had an extra arm that wrested my hand away from the knife. At about 3 a.m., I died for a while. I was wandering, and the world I touched turned into sand. I could hear wind, but the sand did not fly. For 10 years I lost my way. I almost forgot about you. There was so much work leading to other work and another life, like picking up coins in a dream. But I returned. I walked from the Gobi Desert to this room in the To Kwan School. That took another 2 years, outwitting wall ghosts en route. The way to do that is to go straight ahead. Do not play their side-to-side games. In confusion, they will instantly revert to their real state, weak and sad humanity. No matter what, don't commit suicide, or you will have to trade places with the wall ghosts. If you are not put off by the foot-long lolling tongues and the popped-out eyes of the hanged ones, or the open veins, or the drowned skin and seaweed hair, and you shouldn't be because you're doctors, you can chant these poor souls onto light. No white bats and no black bats flew ahead to guide me to my natural death. Either I would die without my whole life, or I would not die. I did not die. I am brave and good. Also, I have bodily strength and control. Good people do not lose to ghosts. Altogether, I was gone for 12 years, but in this room only a half hour had passed. The moon barely moved. By silver light, I saw the black thing pulling shadows into itself, setting up magnetic whirls. Soon it would suck in the room and begin on the rest of the dormitory. It would eat us up. It threw boulders at me, and there was a sound like mountain wind, a sound so high it could drive you crazy. Didn't you hear it? Yes, they had. Wasn't it like the electric wires that one sometimes hears in the city? Yes, it was the sound of energy amassing. You were lucky you slept, because the sound tears the heart. I could hear babies crying in it. I could hear tortured people screaming, and the cries of their relatives who had to watch. Yes, yes, I recognize that. That must have been the singing I heard in my dream. It may be sounding even now, though too strangely for our daytime ears. You cannot hit the ghost if you sweep under the bed. The ghost fattens at night, its dark sacks empty by daylight. It's a good thing I stopped it feeding on me. Blood and meat would have given it strength to feed on you. I made my will an eggshell encasing the monster's fur so that the hollow hairs could not draw. I never let up, willing its size smaller, its hair to retract, until by dawn the sitting ghost temporarily disappeared. The danger is not over. The ghost is listening to us right now. And tonight it will walk again, but stronger. We may not be able to control it if you do not help me finish it off before sundown. This sitting ghost has many wide black mouths. It is dangerous. It is real. Most ghosts make such brief and gauzy appearances that eyewitnesses doubt their own sightings. This one can conjure up enough substance to sit solidly throughout a night. It is a serious ghost, not at all playful. It does not twirl incense sticks or throw shoes and dishes. It does not play peekaboo or wear fright masks. It does not bother with tricks. It wants lives. I am sure it is surfeited with babies and is now coming after adults. It grows. It is mysterious. Not merely a copy of ourselves, as, after all, the hanged men and seaweed women are. It could be hiding right now in a piece of wood or inside one of your dolls. Perhaps in daylight we accept that bag to be just a bag. She pointed with the flat of her palm as if it balanced atop. When in reality, it is a bag ghost. The students moved away from the bag in which they collected the quilting scraps and pulled up their feet that were dangling over the edge of the bed. You have to help me rid the world of this disease, as invisible and deadly as bacteria. After classes, come back here with your buckets, alcohol, and oil. If you can find dog's blood too, our work will go fast. Act unafraid. Ghost chasers have to be brave. If the ghost comes after you, though I would not expect an attack during the day, spit at it. Scorn it. The hero in a ghost story laughs a nimble laugh, his life so full it splatters red and gold on all the creatures around him. These young women, who would have to back up their science with magical spells should their patients be disappointed and not get well, now hurry to get to classes on time. The story about the ghost's appearance and the coming ghost chase grew, and students snatched alcohol and matches from the laboratories. My mother directed the arrangement of the buckets and burners into orderly rows and divided the fuel. "Let's fire the oil all at once," she said. "Now!" "Whoop, whoop," my mother told the sound of new fire so that I remember it. "Whoop, whoop." The alcohol burned a floating blue. The tarry oil, which someone had bought from her village witch, fumed in black clouds. My mother swung a big bucket overhead. The smoke curled in black boas around the women in their scholars' black gowns. They walked the ghost room, this circle of little black women lifting smoke and fire up to the ceiling corners, down to the floor corners, moving clouds across the walls and floors under the bed around one another. "I told you, ghost," my mother chanted, "that we would come after you." "We told you, ghosts, that we would come after you," sang the women. "Daylight has come yellow and red," sang my mother, "and we are winning. Run, ghosts, run from this school. Only good medical people belong here. Go back, dark creature, to your native country. Go home, go home, go home," sang the women. When the smoke cleared, I think my mother said that under the foot of the bed the students found a piece of wood dripping with blood. They burned it in one of the pots, and the stench was like a corpse exhumed for its bones too soon. They laughed at the smell. The students at the Toquan School of Midwifery were new women, scientists who changed the rituals. When she got scared as a child, one of my mother's three mothers had held her and chanted their descent line, reeling the frighted spirit back from the farthest deserts. A relative would know personal names and secrets about husbands, babies, renegades, and decide which ones were lucky in a chant. But these outside women had to build a path from scraps. No blood bonded friend to friend, though there were things owed beggars and monks, and they had to figure out how to help my mother's spirit locate the Tokwan school as home. The calling out of her real descent line would have led her to the wrong place, the village. These strangers had to make her come back to them. They called out their own names, women's pretty names, haphazard names, horizontal names of one generation. They pieced together new directions, and my mother's spirit followed them instead of the old footprints. Maybe that is why she lost her home village and did not reach her husband for 15 years. When my mother led us out of nightmares and horror movies, I felt loved. I felt safe hearing my name sung with hers and my father's, my brothers and sisters, her anger at children who hurt themselves surprisingly gone. An old-fashioned woman would have called in the streets for her sick child. She'd hold its little empty coat unbuttoned. "Come put on your coat, you naughty child." When the coat puffed up, she'd quickly button up the spirit inside and hurry it home to the child's body in bed. But my mother, a modern woman, said our spells in private. "The old ladies in China had many silly superstitions," she said. "I know you'll come back without my making a fool of myself in the streets." Not when we were afraid, but when we were wide awake and lucid, my mother funneled China into our ears. Kwantung Province, New Society Village, the River Kwu, which runs past the village. "Go the way we came, so that you will be able to find our house. Don't forget. Just give your father's name and any villager can point out our house. I am to return to China, where I have never been." After 2 years of study, the graduates of 3-week and 6-week courses were more admired by the peasants for learning at such wondrous speeds. My mother returned to her home village, a doctor. She was welcomed with garlands and symbols the way people welcome the barefoot doctors today. But the communists wear a blue plainness dotted with one red Mao button. My mother wore a silk robe and western shoes with big heels, and she rode home carried in a sedan chair. She had gone away ordinary and come back miraculous, like the ancient magicians who came down from the mountains. When I stepped out of my sedan chair, the villagers said, "Ah," at my good shoes and my long gown. I always dressed well when I made calls. Some villagers brought out their lion and danced ahead of me. You have no idea how much I have fallen coming to America. Until my father sent for her to live in the Bronx, my mother delivered babies in beds and pigsties. She stayed awake, keeping watch nightly in an epidemic and chanted during air raids. She yanked bones straight that had been crooked for years while relatives held the cripples down. And she did all this, never dressed less elegantly than when she stepped out of the sedan chair. Nor did she change her name, Brave Orchid. Professional women have the right to use their maiden names if they like. Even when she emigrated, my mother kept Brave Orchid, adding no American name nor holding one in reserve for American emergencies. Walking behind the palanquin, so that the crowd took her for one of themselves, following the new doctor came a quiet girl. She carried a white puppy and a rice sack knotted at the mouth. Her pigtails and the puppy's tail ended in red yarn. She may have been either a daughter or a slave. When my mother had gone to Canton Market to shop, her wallet had unfolded like wings. She had received a diploma, and it was time to celebrate. She had hunted out the seed shops to taste their lychees, various as wines, and bought a sack that was taller than a child to bedazzle the nieces and nephews. A merchant had given her one nut fresh from its sprig of narrow leaves. My mother popped the thin wood shell in her curled palm. The white fruit, an eye without an iris, ran juices like spring rivers inside my mother's mouth. She spit out the brown seed, iris after all. She had bought a turtle for my grandfather because it would lengthen his life. She had dug to the bottom of fabric piles and explored the shadows underneath awnings. She gave beggars rice and letter writers coins so that they would talk story. Sometimes what I gave was all they had and stories. She let a fortune teller read the whorls on her fingerprints. He predicted that she would leave China and have 6 more children. 6, he said, is the number of everything. You are such a lucky woman. 6 is the universe's number. The 4 compass points plus the zenith and the nadir are 6. There are 6 low phoenix notes and 6 high, 6 worldly environments, 6 senses, 6 virtues, 6 obligations, 6 classes of ideograph, 6 domestic animals, 6 arts, and 6 paths of metempsychosis. More than 2,000 years ago, 6 states combined to overthrow Qin. And of course, there are the hexagrams that are the I Ching. And there is the big 6, which is China. As interesting as his list of 6s was, my mother hurried on her way. She had come to market to buy herself a sleigh. Between the booths and stores, whoever could squeeze a space, a magician who could turn dirt into gold, 25 acrobats on 1 unicycle, a man who could swim, displayed his or her newest feat for money. From the country, the villagers brought strange purple textiles, dolls with big feet, geese with brown tufts on their heads, chickens with white feathers and black skin, gambling games and puppet shows, intricate ways to fold pastry and ancestors' money, a new boxing stance. Herders roped off alleys to pen their goats, which stared out of the dimness with rectangular pupils. Whisking a handful of grass, my mother coaxed them into the light and watched the tiny yellow windows close and open again as the goats skipped backward into the shade. 2 farmers, each leading this year's cow, passed each other, shouting prices. Usually my mother would have given herself up to the pleasure of being in a crowd, delighting in the money game the people would play with the rival herders, who were now describing each other's cows. Skinny shoulder blades, lame legs, patchy hair, ogre face. But today she hurried even when looking over the monkey cages stacked higher than her head. She paused only a while in front of the ducks, which honked madly, the down flying as some passerby bumped into their cages. My mother liked to look at the ducks and plan how she would dig a pond for them near the sweet potato field and arrange straw for their eggs. She decided that the drake with the green head would be the best buy, the noblest, although she would not buy him unless she had money left over. She was already raising a nobler duck on the farm. Among the sellers with their ropes, cages, and water tanks were the sellers of little girls. Sometimes just one man would be standing by the side of the road selling one girl. There were fathers and mothers selling their daughters, whom they pushed forward and then pulled back again. My mother turned her face to look at pottery or embroidery rather than at these miserable families who did not have the sense to leave the favored brothers and sisters home. All the children bore still faces. My mother would not buy from parents, crying and clutching. They would try to keep you talking to find out what kind of mistress you were to your slaves. If they could just hear from the buyer's own mouth about a chair in the kitchen, they could tell each other in the years to come that their daughter was even now resting in the kitchen chair. It was merciful to give these parents a few details about the garden, a sweet, feeble grandmother, food. My mother would buy her sleigh from a professional whose little girls stood neatly in a row and bowed together when a customer looked them over. "How do you do, sir?" they would sing. "How do you do, madam?" "Let a little slave do your shopping for you," the older girls chorused. "We've been taught to bargain. We've been taught to sew. We can cook and we can knit." Some of the dealers merely had the children bow quietly. Others had them sing a happy song about flowers. Unless a group of little girls chanted some especially clever riddle, my mother, who distrusts people with public concerns, braggarts, went over to the quiet older girls with the dignified bows. Any merchant who advertises honest scales must have been thinking about weighting them, she says. Many sellers displayed the sign, "Children and old men not cheated." There were girls barely able to toddle carrying infant slaves tied in slings to their backs. In the undisciplined groups, the babies crawled into gutters, and the older girls each acted as if she were alone, a daughter among slaves. The 1 to 2-year-old babies cost nothing. "Greet the lady," the dealer commanded, just as the nice little girls' mothers had when visitors came.
"How do you do, lady?" said the girls.
My mother did not need to bow back, and she did not. She overlooked the infants and toddlers and talked to the oldest girls. "Open your mouth," she said, "and examine teeth." She pulled down eyelids to check for anemia. She picked up the girls' wrists to sound their pulses, which tell everything. She stopped at a girl whose strong heart sounded like thunder within the earth, sending its power into her fingertips. "I would not have sold a daughter such as that one," she told us. My mother would find no flaw in the beat. It matched her own, the real rhythm. There were people jumpy with silly rhythms, broken rhythms, sly, secretive rhythms. They did not follow the sounds of earth, sea, sky, and the Chinese language. My mother brought out the green notebook my father had given her when he left. It had a map of each hemisphere on the inside covers and a clasp that shut it like a pocketbook. "Watch carefully," she said. With an American pencil, she wrote a word, a felicitous word such as longevity or double joy, which is symmetrical. "Look carefully," she said into the girl's face. "If you can write this word from memory, I will take you with me. Concentrate now." She wrote in a plain style and folded the page a moment afterward. The girl took the pencil and wrote surely. She did not leave out a single stroke. "What would you do," my mother asked, "if you lost a gold watch in a field?"
"I know a chant on the finger bones," said the girl, "but even if I landed on the bone that says to look no more, I would go to the middle of the field and search in a spiral going outward until I reached the field's edge. Then I would believe the chant and look no more."
She drew in my mother's notebook the field and her spiraling path. "How do you cast on yarn?" The girl pantomimed her method with her large hands. "How much water do you put in the rice pot for a family of 5? How do you finish off weaving so that it doesn't unravel?" Now it was time to act as if she were very dissatisfied with the slave's answers, so that the dealer would not charge her extra for a skillful worker.
"You tie the loose ends into tassels," said the girl.
My mother frowned. "But suppose I like a finished border?" The girl hesitated.
"I could, press the fibers under and sew them down, or how about cutting the fibers off?"
My mother offered the dealer half the price he named. "My mother-in-law asked me to find a weaver for her, and obviously she and I will have to waste many months training this girl."
"But she can knit and cook," said the dealer, "and she can find lost watches."
He asked for a price higher than her suggestion, but lower than his first. "I knit and cook and find things," said my mother. "How else do you suppose I think of such ingenious questions? Do you think I would buy a slave who could outwork me in front of my mother-in-law?" My mother walked off to look at a group of hungry slaves across the street. When she returned, the dealer sold her the girl with the finding chant at my mother's price. "I am a doctor," she told her new slave when they were out of the dealer's hearing, "and I shall train you to be my nurse."
"Doctor," said the slave, "do you understand that I do know how to finish off my weaving?"
"Yes, we fooled them very well," said my mother. The unsold slaves must have watched them with envy. I watched them with envy. My mother's enthusiasm for me is duller than for the slave girl. Nor did I replace the older brother and sister who died while they were still cuddly. Throughout childhood, my younger sister said, "When I grow up, I want to be a slave," and my parents laughed, encouraging her. At department stores, I angered my mother when I could not bargain without shame. Poor people's shame. She stood in back of me and prodded and pinched, forcing me to translate her bargaining, word for word. On that same day, she bought at the dog dealer's a white puppy to train as her bodyguard when she made night calls. She tied pretty red yarn around its tail to neutralize the bad luck. There was no use docking the tail. No matter at what point she cut, the tip would have been white, the morning color. The puppy waved its red yarn at the nurse girl, and she picked it up. She followed my mother back to the village, where she always got enough to eat because my mother became a good doctor. She could cure the most spectacular diseases. When a sick person was about to die, my mother would read the fact of it a year ahead of time on the daughters-in-law's faces. A black veil seemed to hover over their skin, and though they laughed, this blackness rose and fell with their breath. My mother would take one look at the daughter-in-law who answered the door at the sick house, and she'd say, "Find another doctor." She would not touch death. Therefore, untainted, she brought only health from house to house. "She must be a Jesus convert," the people from the far villages said. "All her patients get well." The bigger the talk, the farther the distances she traveled. She had customers everywhere. Sometimes she went to her patients by foot. Her nurse slave carried an umbrella when my mother predicted rain and a parasol when she predicted sun. "My white dog would be standing at the door waiting for me whenever I came home," she said. When she felt like it, my mother would leave the nurse slave to watch the office and would take the white dog with her. "What happened to your dog when you came to America, Mother?" "I don't know." "What happened to the slave?" "I found her a husband." "How much money did you pay to buy her?"
$180.
"How much money did you pay the doctor in the hospital when I was born?"
$200.
"Oh, that's $200 American money." "Was the $180 American money?"
"No."
"How much was it American money?"
$50. That's because she was 16 years old. 8-year-olds were about $20. 5-year-olds were $10 and up. 2-year-olds were about $5. Babies were free. During the war, though, when you were born, many people gave older girls away for free. And here I was, in the United States, paying $200 for you.
When my mother went doctoring in the villages, the ghosts, the were-people, the apes dropped out of trees. They rose out of bridge water. My mother saw them come out of cervixes. Medical science does not seal the earth, whose nether creatures seep out, hair by hair, disguised like the smoke that dispels them. She had apparently won against the one ghost, but ghost forms are various and many. Some can occupy the same space at the same moment. They permeate the grain and wood, metal and stone. Animalcules somersault about our faces when we breathe. We have to build horns on our roofs so that the nagging once people can slide up them and perhaps ascend to the stars, the source of pardon and love. On a fine spring day, the villagers at a place my mother had never visited before would wave peach branches and fans, which are emblems of Cheng Li Chuan, the chief of the 8 sages and keeper of the elixir of life. The pink petals would fall on my mother's black hair and gown. The villagers would set off firecrackers as on New Year's Day. If it had really been New Year's, she would have had to shut herself up in her own house. Nobody wanted a doctor's visit in the first days of the year. But at night, my mother walked quickly. She and bandits were the only human beings out, no palanquins available for midwives. For a time, the roads were endangered by a fantastic creature, half man and half ape, that a traveler to the west had captured and brought back to China in a cage. With his new money, the man had built the 4th wing to his house, and in the courtyard he grew a stand of bamboo. The ape man could reach out and touch the thin leaves that shaded its cage. This creature had gnawed through the bars, or it had tricked its owner into letting it play in the courtyard and then leapt over the roof of the new wing. Now it was at large in the forests, living off squirrels, mice, and an occasional duck or piglet. My mother saw in the dark a denser dark, and she knew she was being followed. She carried a club, and the white dog was beside her. The ape man was known to have attacked people. She had treated their bites and claw wounds. With hardly a rustle of leaves, the ape man leapt live out of the trees and blocked her way. The white dog yelped.
As big as a human being, the ape thing jumped up and down on one foot. Its two hands were holding the other foot, hurt in the jump. It had long orange hair and beard. Its owner had clothed it in a brown burlap rice sack with holes for neck and arms. It blinked at my mother with human eyes, moving its head from shoulder to shoulder as if figuring things out.
"Go home," she shouted, waving her club.
It copied her waving with one raised arm and made complex motions with its other hand. But when she rushed at it, it turned and ran limping into the forest.
"Don't you scare me again," she yelled after its retreating buttocks, tailless and hairless under the shirt.
It was definitely not a gorilla. She has since seen some of those at the Bronx Zoo, and this ape man was nothing like them. If her father had not brought Third Wife, who was not Chinese, back from his travels, my mother might have thought this orange creature with the great nose was a barbarian from the West. But my grandfather's Third Wife was black with hair so soft that it would not hang, instead blowing up into a great brown puffball. At first she talked constantly, but who could understand her? After a while she never talked anymore. She had one son. The owner of the ape man finally recaptured it by luring it back into its cage with cooked pork and wine. Occasionally, my mother went to the rich man's house to look at the ape man. It seemed to recognize her and smiled when she gave it candy. Perhaps it had not been an ape man at all, but one of the Tigermen, a savage northern race. My mother was midwife to whatever spewed forth, not being able to choose as with the old and sick. She was not squeamish, though, and deftly caught spewings that were sometimes babies, sometimes monsters. When she helped the country women who insisted on birthing in the pig pen, she could not tell by starlight and moonlight what manner of creature had made its arrival on the earth until she carried it inside the house. "Pretty pig baby, pretty piglet," she and the mother would croon, fooling the ghosts on the lookout for a new birth. "Ugly pig, dirty pig," fooling the gods jealous of human joy. They counted fingers and toes by touch, felt for penis or no penis, but not until later would they know for sure whether the gods let them get away with something good. One boy appeared perfect, so round in the cool opal dawn. But when Mother examined him indoors, he opened up blue eyes at her. Perhaps he had looked without protection at the sky and it had filled him. His mother said that a ghost had entered him, but my mother said the baby looked pretty. Not all defects could be explained so congenially. One child, born without an anus, was left in the outhouse so that the family would not have to hear it cry. They kept going back to see whether it was dead yet, but it lived for a long time. Whenever they went to look at it, it was sobbing, heaving as if it was trying to defecate. For days, the family would either walk to the fields or use the night soil buckets. As a child, I pictured a naked child sitting on a modern toilet, desperately trying to perform until it died of congestion. I had to flick on the bathroom lights fast so that no small shadow would take a baby shape. Sometimes seated on the edge of the bathtub, its hopes for a bowel movement so exaggerated. When I woke at night, I sometimes heard an infant's grunting and weeping coming from the bathroom. I did not go to its rescue, but waited for it to stop. I hope this holeless baby proves that my mother did not prepare a box of clean ashes beside the birthbed in case of a girl. The midwife or a relative would take the back of a girl baby's head in her hand and turn her face into the ashes, said my mother. It was very easy. She never said she herself killed babies, but perhaps the holeless baby was a boy. Even here on Gold Mountain, grateful couples bring gifts to my mother, who had cooked them a soup that not only ended their infertility, but gave them a boy. My mother has given me pictures to dream, nightmare babies that recur, shrinking again and again to fit in my palm. I curl my fingers to make a cradle for the baby, my other hand an awning. I would protect the dream baby, not let it suffer, not let it out of my sight. But in a blink of inattention, I would mislay the baby. I would have to stop moving, afraid of stepping on it. Or before my very eyes, it slips between my fingers because my fingers cannot grow webs fast enough. or bathing it, I carefully turn the right-hand faucet, but it spouts hot water, scalding the baby until its skin tautens and its face becomes nothing but a red hole of a scream. The hole turns into a pinprick as the baby recedes from me. To make my waking life American normal, I turn on the lights before anything untoward makes an appearance. I push the deformed into my dreams, which are in Chinese, the language of impossible stories. Before we can leave our parents, they stuff our heads like the suitcases, which they jam-pack with homemade underwear. When the thermometer in our laundry reached 111 degrees on summer afternoons, either my mother or father would say that it was time to tell another ghost story so that we could get some good chills up our backs. My parents, my brothers, sisters, great-uncle, and third aunt, who wasn't really our aunt but a fellow villager, someone else's third aunt, kept the presses crashing and hissing and shouted out the stories. Those were our successful days, when so much laundry came in my mother did not have to pick tomatoes. For breaks, we changed from pressing to sorting. "One twilight," my mother began, and already the chills traveled my back and crossed my shoulders. The hair rose at the nape and the back of the legs. I was walking home after doctoring a sick family. To get home, I had to cross a footbridge. In China, the bridges are nothing like the ones in Brooklyn and San Francisco. This one was made from rope, laced and knotted as if by magpies. Actually, it had been built by men who had returned after harvesting sea swallow nests in Malaya. They had had to swing over the faces of the Malayan cliffs in baskets they had woven themselves. Though this bridge pitched and swayed in the updraft, no one had ever fallen into the river, which looked like a bright scratch at the bottom of the canyon, as if the Queen of Heaven had swept her great silver hairpin across the earth as well as the sky. One twilight, just as my mother stepped on the bridge, two smoky columns spiraled up taller than she. Their swaying tops hovered over her head like white cobras, one at either handrail. From stillness came a wind rushing between the smoke spindles. A high sound entered her temple bones. Through the twin whirlwinds, she could see the sun and the river twisting in circles, the trees upside down. The bridge moved like a ship, sickening. The earth dipped. She collapsed to the wooden slats, a ladder up the sky, her fingers so weak she could not grip the rungs. The wind dragged her hair behind her, then whipped it forward across her face. Suddenly, the smoke spindles disappeared. The world righted itself, and she crossed to the other side. She looked back, and there was nothing there. She used the bridge often, but she did not encounter those ghosts again.
"They were Sitdumgwe," said great-uncle. "Sitdumgwe."
"Yes, of course," said my mother. "Sitdumgwe." I keep looking in dictionaries under those syllables. Gui means ghost, but I don't find any other words that make sense. I only hear my great-uncle's river pirate voice, the voice of a big man who had killed someone in New York or Cuba, make the sounds.
Sitdumgwe.
How do they translate? When the communists issued their papers on techniques for combating ghosts, I looked for Sitdumgwe. I have not found them described anywhere. Although now I see that my mother won in ghost battle because she can eat anything. Quick, pluck out the carp's eyes, one for mother and one for father. All heroes are bold toward food. In the research against ghost fear published by the Chinese Academy of Science is the story of a magistrate's servant, Cao Cheng, a capable eater who in 1683 ate 5 cooked chickens and drank 10 bottles of wine that belonged to the sea monster with branching teeth. The monster had arranged its food around a fire on the beach and started to feed when Cao Cheng attacked. The swan feather sword he wrested from this monster can be seen in the Wentung County Armory in Shantung today. Another big eater was Chao Yihan of Changchow, who fried a ghost. It was a meaty steak when he cut it up and cooked it. But before that, it had been a woman out at night. Cheng Ruanfen, during the Yuan Ho era of the Tang Dynasty, A.D. 806 through 820,
ate yellow croaker and pork together, which the thunder god had forbidden. But Chen wanted to incur thunderbolts during drought. The first time he ate, the thunder god jumped out of the sky, its legs like old trees. Chen chopped off the left one. The thunder god fell to the earth, and the villagers could see that it was a blue pig, or bear with horns and fleshy wings. Chen leaped on it, prepared to chop its head and bite its throat, but the villagers stopped him. After that, Chen lived apart as a rainmaker, neither relatives nor the monks willing to bring lightning upon themselves. He lived in a cave, and for years, whenever there was drought, the villagers asked him to eat yellow croaker and pork together, and he did. The most fantastic eater of them all was Wei Pang, a scholar hunter for the Ta Li era of the Tang Dynasty, A.D. 766 through 779. He shot and cooked rabbits and birds, but he could also eat scorpions, snakes, cockroaches, worms, slugs, beetles, and crickets. Once he spent the night in a house that had been abandoned because its inhabitants feared contamination from the dead man next door. A shining, twinkling sphere came flying through the darkness at Wei. He felled it with three true arrows, the first making the thing crackle and flame, the second dimming it, and the third putting out its lights, sputter. When his servant came running in with a lamp, Wei saw his arrows sticking in a ball of flesh entirely covered with eyes. Some rolled back to show the dawning whites. He and the servant pulled out the arrows and cut up the ball into little pieces. The servant cooked the morsels in sesame oil, and the wonderful aroma made Wei laugh. They ate half, saving half to show the household, which would return now. Big eaters win. When other passers-by stepped around the bundle wrapped in white silk, the anonymous scholar of Han Chao took it home. Inside were three silver ingots and a frog-like evil, which sat on the ingots. The scholar laughed at it and chased it off. That night, two frogs the size of year-old babies appeared in his room. He clubbed them to death, cooked them, and ate them with white wine. The next night, a dozen frogs, together the size of a pair of year-old babies, jumped from the ceiling. He ate all 12 for dinner. The third night, 30 small frogs were sitting on his mat and staring at him with their frog eyes. He ate them too. Every night for a month, smaller but more numerous frogs came so that he always had the same amount to eat. Soon, his floor was like the healthy banks of a pond in spring when the tadpoles, having just turned, sprang in the wet grass. "Get a hedgehog to help eat," cried his family. "I'm as good as a hedgehog," the scholar said, laughing. And at the end of the month, the frogs stopped coming, leaving the scholar with the white silk and silver ingots. My mother has cooked for us raccoons, skunks, hawks, city pigeons, wild ducks, wild geese, black-skinned bantams, snakes, garden snails, turtles that crawled about the pantry floor and sometimes escaped under refrigerator or stove, catfish that swam in the bathtub. "The emperors used to eat the peaked hump of purple dromedaries," she would say. "They used chopsticks made from rhinoceros horn, and they ate ducks' tongues and monkeys' lips." She boiled the weeds we pulled up in the yard. There was a tender plant with flowers like white stars hiding under the leaves, which were like the flower petals, but green. I've not been able to find it since growing up. It had no taste. When I was as tall as the washing machine, I stepped out on the back porch one night, and some heavy, ruffling, windy, clawed thing dived at me. Even after getting chanted back to sensibility, I shook when I recalled that. Perched everywhere, there were owls with great hunched shoulders and yellow scowls. They were a surprise for my mother,